what's going on with Earl Ingram. And a long overdue segment that I kind of got into last year quite a bit, and had a lot of people who asked me what happened, because they certainly, our viewing audience and listening audience is, I would say, long of tooth, to be kind. And so they enjoyed the conversations that I had with the doctors from Frederick and the Medical Center Health Network. I'm happy that we're going back to that. And I hope that this is the beginning of, you know, what will be many, many more. Because I've always said, what's the purpose of having a platform if it's not used to give valuable and pertinent information to those who listen? With that backdrop, I want to welcome Dr. Jeremiah Depta. He's an interventional cardiologist with the Frederick and the Medical Center Health Network of Wisconsin. Good morning to you, doctor. Thank you very much for taking the time out of your very busy schedule.
I appreciate the opportunity to talk with you, Earl, and excited to talk about all these exciting things in our field and engage your listeners.
So let's begin at the beginning. What is an interventional cardiologist?
That is a great question. So cardiology has a lot of different specialties. Specifically, an interventional cardiologist is a cardiologist who performs procedures using a catheter and trying to recreate what surgeons would have done in open heart surgery to fix the heart.
So you talk about a catheter. So, you know, again, we're the people who, you know, this is being done to, so we don't know exactly what surgeons are doing. So if I'm a person and I'm listening to this and you're saying the catheter, what is a catheter?
Oh, absolutely. So that's a really important point, because we say catheter all the time and people are wondering what that is. So let me walk you through kind of what like a patient experience is. So when somebody's going to get a catheter-based procedure, basically they'll come into the hospital the same morning. You often don't have to come in the day before. Patients may not even need general anesthesia. And oftentimes they'll get a small amount of lidocaine that we put in the area. And then we don't even do any cutting at all with an incision. And we access either the groin, the wrist, the neck, really with a small needle and a wire. And then we put a catheter, which is a flexible tube, into the blood vessel, and then guide that towards the heart. And we watch the whole journey of that tube using X-ray or echo. And once we reach the heart, we can either do diagnostic procedures, trying to diagnose something, or using it to treat something. As an example, putting a stent in a blockage and that somebody may have in an artery, or even deliver valves, which we'll talk about.
You know, this is just so fascinating to me, because I'm from that era where if you had a problem with your heart, they'd crack your sternum. And they had a team of specialists, and they opened you wide open, and they had to physically address the maladies in your heart. We've long since passed that.
We are. And I'm not going to say that open heart surgery isn't needed for some people. But the reality is that the change in being able to do things in a less invasive way is really nothing short of revolutionary. I'll give you a really good example. You know, most people have heard of people getting stents in the blockages of arteries of the heart.
Right, I have one. I have one, but go ahead.
You have one, and we chatted a little bit about that before starting the session. That's been around for a couple decades, but now we can replace or repair the heart valve. Interestingly, a French interventional cardiologist, he passed in 2024, his name's Alain Cribier. He had a patient who was in his mid-60s dying in France. No option for surgery at all. He had a severe valve condition. And he says, you know, I've been putting stents in for years. What if I put a valve inside of a stent? Can I deliver it to that valve the same way that I put the stents inside the tiny arteries? He did it. The patient survived. And that spurned this entire field of what is called structural heart disease, meaning fixing structures within the heart without open heart surgery, which has, again, been incredibly revolutionary in what we're able to offer people.
You know, doctor, we, the American people, and just the average everyday Joes, don't have any concept at all about all the different arteries and veins and other things that lead to your heart. And so there is almost seems an endless opportunity for any of those things to fail. It's really pretty fascinating and amazing that you can live as long as, for instance, say a person of my age to have lived and hopefully to have a lot of life left before me. And your veins and arteries and those kinds of things that carry the blood to your heart don't get clogged more. Is it safe to say that?
It is. And I think we've learned not only through what have been traditional technologies, but now that we have very advanced imaging CAT scans and MRIs, we are able to find ways to get to the heart that we never even thought of. And so regardless of somebody's age or medical condition, we usually can find ways to perform these less invasive procedures if that's the right procedure for that patient. And that's, again, incredibly exciting for patients. But you, Earl, you will be surprised. I have been so surprised, and I know you're talking about feeling older in your 70s, but I see so many people who are in their 80s and 90s. I would say about a third of the people that I do valve repair or valve replacement on in their 80s and 90s. Right or wrong, the oldest person I put a valve in was 106.
Wow.
Which is incredible. Feisty lady, 106, still riding a bike, was getting out of breath, said, I don't want to feel like this. I want to live. Went through it just fine. Really amazing things. For people living into really what I would say, we call it advanced age, it's not a very nice term, but living well into their 80s and 90s and doing so much and being so functional, I think it gives everybody hope for the future.
You know, doctor, tricuspid valve disease. What is tricuspid valve? What is that?
That is great. So you hit on something that's really, really exciting and timely. So the tricuspid valve is on the right side of the heart, and it has been called the forgotten valve, and predominantly because we really didn't have options for it, and traditional open heart surgery was a very high risk venture. What the tricuspid valve does is as blood flows from the body and the right side of the heart pushes blood up to the lungs to get oxygen, the tricuspid valve is supposed to be a trap door to allow blood to flow forward. And there's a condition called tricuspid regurgitation. We say TR. But tricuspid regurgitation is when that valve doesn't close properly and blood will flow backwards. Causes people not to feel well. It also can cause people to lead towards passing away from this. But now we have options that didn't exist that allow people to get that valve repaired or replaced. Before, we had no options for patients at all. And now people are able to get these sort of procedures, which is, again, something that didn't exist in medicine.
So is that non-invasive as well?
It is. Both of these procedures, you go through the groin or the neck. People are asleep for it, but I'll show you an example if I can do. This is an example of a valve that we are able to put in somebody who has a tricuspid valve. Now, this is when it's been opened, but we actually deliver it through that catheter, through that tube, and deploy a valve to completely replace their valve and recreate what a surgeon would do if they had to go in there and replace a patient's valve. That procedure takes around 2 hours, but as an example, patients will go home within 1 to 2 days of the procedure with very, very minimal restrictions, really not driving for a couple days, lifting anything heavy for a couple days, but they're back into their full activity, usually within a week.
Atrial fibrillation. I can't.
Yes.
What is that?
So that's a great question. So it's a mouthful when you say atrial fibrillation. We say AFib.
Okay.
That's the easier way to say it. Even as doctors, we say that as well. It's a lot easier. AFib is the most common heart arrhythmia in the body, in humans. And it increases as people get older. And what it means is the top chambers, instead of contracting normally, so how the heart works is it has a electrical system that coordinates how that electricity flows through the heart to allow the top chambers to squeeze and then the bottom chambers. And that's what allows the heart to squeeze blood to keep it going forward. That's what keeps us alive. When people get AFib, what that means is that the top chambers are fibrillating. They're not actually contracting. There's not the right electrical activity. That can cause people to feel it and not feel well. That's why we try to get people back into their rhythm, either using medicine or doing a procedure where we can ablate, meaning burning inside the heart using those catheters. But importantly as well, when you have AFib, it significantly increases your risk of stroke. 5 to 6 times higher than normal. So it is very common that people have to be on blood thinners for that. But now, as medicine has evolved, there's a lot of people who can't handle being on blood thinners or don't want to be on blood thinners. Now we have a procedure called Watchman, where you can put a device into the heart that will protect patients who have AFib to the same extent as if they were on a blood thinner. So it just shows you how exciting medicine is and the things that we're able to do in something that is very, very common.
So all of this is more than fascinating to me, and I trust to other listeners of this program, because, you know, you hear about irregular heartbeat. You hear about, you know, the rhythm being off it and all those kinds of things. How dangerous is that, and how do you determine, what the solution is?
Another great question, Earl. The good thing is that the majority of time, overwhelming majority of the time, it's not a dangerous rhythm per se. If it's very infrequent, meaning people will feel like a skip beat or feel very briefly and it rarely happens, that's pretty common. And more often just extra heartbeats that people get. If it becomes more frequent, or let's say somebody gets where they feel like their heart is fluttering for a period of time and it is not going away, they should get evaluated. If they feel unwell, they feel lightheaded, they feel very out of breath, obviously you're going to call, 911. Again, that scenario is not as common. But importantly, if you do have those symptoms, either the ones that are infrequent or things that are that is more sudden, letting a physician know immediately, either your primary care doctor or if you do see a heart doctor. And more often than not, they'll do an EKG, or they could alternatively put a monitor on to see what is actually is going on. And depending on what it is, we'll then determine what we can offer patients.
You know, if you're just joining us, I am joined by Dr. Jeremiah Depta. He's an interventional cardiologist with Frederick and the Medical Center Health Network of Wisconsin. So, doctor, I will say to you, I'm a guy who's had my sternum cracked before, okay? And I know the pain that went along with waiting for that bone to heal and to come back together. When we talk about recovery, I couldn't imagine how much time it takes once you do they crack the sternum and go in and do all that they have to do when you have to have heart surgery done. But my God, if you're talking about being able to avoid that recovery time, that's got to be not only great for the patient, but great for the hospital, great for the insurance companies, great for everybody.
You're exactly right. And I think it shows the evolution in medicine, the evolution of science. Certain people may need open heart surgery, and we have really talented surgeons here, but it's a lot to go through. You know it personally, but you know it can be a month, 2 months for it to recover. And it takes time to recover when you go through open heart surgery. But the great thing is, and let's just focus on valve replacement, that an example like something as aortic stenosis, which is a narrowing of the aortic valve, very, very common. 1 in 8 adults over the age of 75 have it. That's something that was always done by open heart surgery. Now, 90%+ of people get that valve procedure through the groin. Takes around a half an hour to do. You don't have to be under general anesthesia. Patients are walking within a couple hours of the procedure. People can even go home the same day as the procedure or just stay overnight. And that recovery is dramatically different. And that allows people to not get deconditioned and have to fight so hard after going through major open heart surgery. You're right that it's an advantage to everybody. But the great thing is that we're able to do this. And the other thing too is this alternative. It's not that it's less compared to what you get with a surgery valve. They're either showing to be equivocal or even better at times, which is amazing.
You know, Dr. Depta, I would say that, again, an assumption, and only an assumption, because how else would I know? I'm just a lowly talk show guy. If there was a time when elders, 70s, 60s, 80s, they would hesitate doing major heart surgery if they could, because of our advanced age, would be more difficult to do those things. Does this make it, more likely that they can have the surgery done and recovery is quicker because of the age differential?
Absolutely. So open heart surgery used to be a higher risk venture for people who are older. But the procedures that I'm talking about, the catheter-based treatments where you can replace valves, are low risk procedures, regardless of age. And that is really remarkable. I'll give you an interesting story. It was the second time I did valve replacement about a decade ago. I was in Rochester, New York. And it was a lady who is 88 years old. She had been in a wheelchair, had complete all her wits, amazing, interacting with her family, but couldn't breathe. Surgeon would never do surgery on that patient. She wouldn't survive. Interestingly, her family was a little reluctant. So, she's been in a wheelchair. What should I do? And said, okay, I'm willing to help you out. And we did the procedure. Everything went fine. She went home the next day. She did fine in follow-up. After the first year, she was just following with a regular cardiologist. 8 years after I did that procedure, I got a card from the family. And it made me realize how the impact of something where you say, you know what, you're doing a procedure on somebody that age who's in a wheelchair. She had lived 8 years. She had seen a number of weddings, graduations, grandkids being born, great grandkids being born, enjoying life. And the family thanked me. And for all their reluctance and perseveration about should somebody her age go through that, they thanked me so much that they had that opportunity. And the idea that we can allow people to have that choice and to have the opportunity to feel well and maintain a quality of life is something where I was very, you know, it was very heartfelt for me to receive that. But, you know, when I look back, you know, those are the things that are very gratifying to me.
You know, Dr. Depter, to me, when you look at the advancements of science, of robotics, of AI, I go to the gym, and when I go to the gym, at 70 years old, I'm youthful because I see people who 10, 15 years ago, I wouldn't see at the gym working out like that. They're well past their 80s, their mid 80s, and yet they're there, and yet they're moving, and they understand the importance of the connection between keeping active, keeping busy. But along the way, I don't think they could have done that unless the advancements of what is happening with, you know, robotics and AI and all those other care improvements in care that make them comfortable enough to do that.
I agree with you completely. I think medicine has gotten us in a place where people, as they age, they can continue to do these things. But I will also say, I always say I'd love to write a book on what I learned from my 90-year-old patient. And what I mean, you know, but I said the number one thing I've learned in all the 90-year-olds I've seen over the years, especially the ones I've had to treat with for valve repair or valve replacements through these catheter-based treatments, the one thing that is with all of them, they're active. They stay active to whatever extent it is. Is it going to the gym? Is it doing exercise in their house? Is it walking in the hallway? Is it going and seeing friends? Is it even working? Is it having a part-time job? Is it keeping mentally active, physically active? And for me, being younger, I've said, you know, that's something that, regardless of what I know in medicine, I'm going to do my very best in my own life. But I think that is one of the messages and the keys I will say to your audience is stay active. Don't just say, I'm too old to do these things. You're not. Now, you may not be able to do it to the same extent when you're younger, but it doesn't mean you shouldn't do it.
So, doctor, let me ask you, because as I stated earlier, I have a cardiologist, and my cardiologist is at Frederick. And, you know, I actually have several doctors, and all my doctors are at Frederick. And so I'm a person who believes totally in what happens at Frederick Hospital. It's because my life is in their hands, so to speak. And to be quite frank with you, I'm thriving at this juncture in my life. But I would ask you, when I go see my cardiologist, there are people who may be concerned, well, if the cardiologist sees you, you guys work together, you non-invasive doctors and my own cardiologist, if she sees something that may not require surgery, does she then make the decision to send that information to you guys interact and work together?
all the time. It works seamlessly. There's a lot that goes on behind the scenes. Interventional cardiologists like myself, we actually are cardiologists. We just went to more training to do the procedures. It isn't, so you had to be a cardiologist before you become an interventional cardiologist. But needless to say, all of our cardiologists here work very, very closely with the procedural fields, either surgical or less invasive fields like interventional cardiology. That there really aren't barriers anymore. I would say, though, that if a patient or one of your audience members feels like that they're not getting to the right physicians, I would never hesitate to say it's okay to get a second opinion. Some people are afraid to go get a second opinion. And sometimes you get a second opinion and they might say, hey, everything is good. Or your physicians that are taking care of you are doing a great job. I've had second opinions come to me where I will reinforce that to patients. But it's okay for listeners to reach out, and making sure that they are aware of all the options they have available.
Doctor, let me ask you, for instance, because we're talking about, you know, cardiologists, and we're talking about problems with the heart, and we generally associate that with people who are a bit long of tooth. But clearly, it's not just about people who are long of tooth. There are young people who have heart conditions and, may never even know it. How do you suggest? I mean, that's not something that's normally done when a young patient goes to see a doctor. They're not going to all of a sudden examine them for a heart issue. What's the connection, and how do you determine if your loved one, your child, has a, what is the sign?
Well, you know, certainly it's going to depend on what's going on. I will say this, and maybe a cautionary tale, is that I think with youth, we oftentimes feel that you can get away with more than you can. And specifically that you may have unrecognized medical conditions and feel that that you don't need to address it. There's a lot on the internet, so you kind of head to the internet and start Googling and taking care of your own health without physician input. And I think it's great to go to the internet and get resources. But it's interesting. I'm always surprised at how many younger patients come in to the hospital with heart attacks. And people sometimes in their 30s and 40s who have a heart attack where we have to bring the emergency team in and open up an artery in the vessel. More often than not, it's because they have medical conditions that were unrecognized or even more often, untreated. Or they have lifestyle choices that are going to put them in that position where they can have a serious heart condition. There's no free lunch when you have certain lifestyle choices. And people need to be aware of that. And even though you say your audience is long in the tooth, but I would say that, you know, with age becomes wisdom, you realize how important it is to address your medical problems and work with your medical providers to make sure you're as healthy as you possibly can be.
You know, doctor, prevention. We don't talk much about prevention. We talk about, I mean, you guys do, but we don't. And some of these things are preventable. If we're gonna smoke, even in the face of what information is already out there, and it's been out there now for 40 years, for 50 years, and yet we still smoke. And I know it's a habit. It's like other things, overeating. in all sorts of other things that we do that aren't good for us. It's part of the human condition. Long term, these things aren't good for your body. They're not good for your health, and they can lead to these kinds of things as we get older. Is it safe to say that?
Agreed, and you're absolutely right. I mean, there's primary prevention versus secondary prevention. Those terms we use in medicine. But primary prevention is trying to prevent something before it even starts. And a lot of that, secondary prevention means after you diagnose somebody, then you're trying to prevent bad events from happening. But primary prevention is often on each of us to do the sort of things to make sure we prevent ourselves from, to the extent we can, control. And heart disease, not always, but heart disease, specifically when you talk about plaque building up in the arteries, a lot of that is lifestyle. And a lot, there's some genetics with it. We can't control that. You know, we can't control our genetics. But our choices, we can. You know, it's interesting. Like, you take a patient who, let's say they have a family history of heart attacks, and they'll come in to me with a heart attack, and they've been smoking since they were 18. They have high cholesterol, and they're diabetic, and they're not seeing physicians for either of those conditions. What do you think is going to happen? And I don't mean to be negative,
right?
But I don't know what people expect, that all of a sudden, and the awful thing, and I've seen it on people's face when they come in and they realize kind of that oh boy moment, like, I've been doing this to myself, and now I am changed, meaning I've come in with a heart attack, and this doctor here is trying to open up that artery to save my life, but now my heart is different. I am on a different pathway, all because of the choices I've made over that lifetime. I wish we weren't in that situation sometimes.
You know, doctor, I recall not so long, well, it was a long time ago, I don't know what they're doing now, but when you had your arteries clogged, and they would, this is probably old technology now, they would send angioplasty, I guess they used to call it, where they would send, do they still do angioplasty?
That's how we do angioplasty. Means I just take a balloon. So what happens in these arteries are very tiny. We're talking millimeters in diameter. And so the first sort of prior to catheter-based treatments, interventional cardiology, a surgeon, if there's a blockage, would just bypass. They take a vein or an artery and bypass around that blockage. Similar to kind of how we, when we're trying to get around construction, we have bypasses. But then came the idea of angioplasty. That is when you put a wire past that blockage, you inflate a balloon. But it only was a balloon. But what they found with angioplasty is that the vessels would like to close, either shortly after the procedure or long term. So then they put stents in there, and stent is a metal tube, a small mesh metal tube that allows that vessel to keep open, and it has medication on it to help prevent the body from reacting to that stent, so that stent stays open long term. And that is the field of, that is what interventional cardiology, the field was born out of, is really doing that.
So let me ask you one other thing before we get out of here. I know you're a very busy man, but just for the listeners and myself, the heart, like all the other organs of the body, is an unbelievable instrument that we all take for granted because we don't see it. It's inside of us. We don't understand its inner workings. If you can simplify for us, maybe it might help us in the long run, what that heart actually does. Maybe we'll adhere to protection and protecting it more than we do.
Happy to. So the heart is an amazing organ. I'm biased because I'm a cardiologist, but the heart is a pump. And the goal of the heart is to keep moving blood that is going to carry oxygen to the entire body and bring oxygen to everywhere in the body so that those organs and those tissues can stay alive and do their normal function. So the heart is designed to contract in a way that keeps that blood moving forward. It has its own blood supply because it's got to stay alive because it's just made of tissue, right?
Right.
And so, but the predominant thing is that the heart has to move blood. That's all it does. Now, it's obviously a complicated organ. It's amazing when you see, and it's amazing when you think evolutionary how it's gotten, our maker has gotten to where it is today. But the goal is just to move blood. And all the things that we need to do to keep the heart functioning properly and making sure that blood is moving forward is what cardiology is, in a sense.
So all the other organs of your body depend on the heart to keep them moving and keep them alive, because the blood flow is what makes all of that possible, what feeds the cells and all those kind of things. Is that kind of how it works?
100%. If the heart stops, they can't get the blood, they can't get the oxygen, you don't survive. That's when somebody has a cardiac arrest, meaning when their heart stops and they have to do CPR. So what is CPR? CPR is just pushing on the chest that is pushing the blood that's in the heart to try to get it to keep moving forward, to keep the rest of the body alive.
So it's prolonging until something can happen.
CPR until we can get the heart to restart.
You know, doctor, I will say to you, Dr. Depta, it has been a great conversation. It's been a learning conversation, as all of these conversations that we've had with the Medical College of Brayden and the Medical College of Wisconsin and all the different doctors. You are no different, very well versed and trained in what you do, but able to explain it in a manner that even just an average Joe like myself can understand it. And I think that's what we need more of. And so as long as I have an opportunity to have this platform, we're going to continue to bring you guys on this platform so people can understand. Because, you know, in the end, you only get one life, right? Got to prolong it as long as we can.
I agree with you, Earl. And I think the most important thing for me is to your audience and your listeners, I want them to take away that there's a lot of hope now and in the future. If you don't feel well or your loved ones don't feel well, there are more options today to get help than ever before. We have conditions now that major surgeries needed, and now we can treat through tiny little punctures. And technology is improving. These available treatments are available right here in Milwaukee.
So
ask the questions. Oh, sorry, go ahead.
No, finish your point.
Yeah, ask questions to your doctors, advocate for yourself, and just know that you can get really excellent care locally.
So just a little fun, a little humor. Yeah. Baron von Dr. Depta Frankenstein. I was thinking about you. Doctor, thank you very much. We appreciate it from the depths of our heart. Keep up the good work, and hopefully we'll cross paths again.
100%. Thank you very much for your time, Earl. I appreciate you doing this for all the listeners in Milwaukee and all the people here, okay?
This goes farther than Milwaukee. This is everywhere, sir. But thank you very much. I really appreciate it. Have
thank
a great
you,
day.
Appreciate
See you soon.
Yes,
all right. Thanks to the Medical College, Brayden and the Medical College of Wisconsin for continuing to allow us this really important dialogue, and especially for you, the listening audience, for another what's going on with Earl Ingram. It's another wrap. We'll see you soon.